From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The high price of cheap clothing. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Almost 400 garment workers died, hundreds suffered crushed rib cages and amputations in last week's building collapse in Bangladesh. A recent fire killed 112 factory workers. But Bangladesh won't enforce its own laws on working conditions so it can remain the cheapest clothing maker in Asia. Walmart, H&M, JCPenney, and other Western companies have refused to fund an independent inspection program. Would that make a difference? Should the U.S. and other Western governments apply pressure under international trade agreements? In the meantime, what's a consumer to do? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the author of a hopeful book in what seems like a hopeless time. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The deadly collapse of a garment factory in Bangladesh has increased political unrest in that country, and brand-name Western clothing makers are accused of shirking responsibility. What about consumers who demand low prices? Could Bangladesh go the way of other Asian countries that enforce their laws on wages and working conditions? On Reporter's Notebook and a new book, Jim Wallace of Sojourners wants to start a national conversation about the common good. We'll talk to him in our studio. First, this news update on the 100th day of his second term. President Obama had a news conference today ranging from criticism of Congress to praising NBA player Jason Collins for coming out of the closet. He said once again that the use of chemical weapons by Syria would be a game changer, but said it's still too early to take any action.
If we end up rushing to judgment without hard, effective evidence, then we can find ourselves in a position where we can't mobilize the international community to support what we do.
Rachel Smolkin is deputy managing editor of Politico.com. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here. Thank you very much.
The president does not seem eager to rush into Syria in any way.
He absolutely doesn't, and we knew that based on the administration's response so far, but if there were any doubt about that, he really emphasized it at his news conference today. He talked about gathering the facts and not rushing into these kinds of things, and without ever using the word Iraq, he drew a clear distinction between his approach of slowly gathering the facts and the prospect to rushing to war.
Did he talk about his trip to Mexico?
He talked a little bit about that. I mean, it was an interesting news conference because he started out with Syria. That was the first question he got. Really spent a fair amount of time on that and his conception of game changer. Of course, he had said that we knew if the administration found proof of chemical weapons use there. He had previously called that a red line. That would be a game changer. Much of the news conference today was spent sort of recalibrating a bit the use of the word game changer to say that it really meant that we'd go back and look at our options. So it was really more Syria that was dominant and made the biggest news out of the news conference today. And then he talked about other issues, you know, mentioning his trip, mentioning immigration, talking a little bit about sequester. But if you talk about the biggest takeaway out of today, it was definitely his remarks about Syria and the use of the word game changer.
He was asked about, on his 100th day of his second term, about whether the failure to pass gun control was part of the evidence that he might have lost his juice with the Congress.
You seem to suggest that somehow these folks over there have no responsibilities and that my job is to somehow get them to behave. That's their job.
And he blasted Congress for using long-term money for airport construction to end that furloughing of air traffic controllers.
We're using our seed corn short-term, and the only reason we're doing it is because right now we've got folks who are unwilling to make some simple changes to our tax code, for example, to close loopholes that aren't adding to our competitiveness and aren't helping middle-class families.
Back to Rachel Smolkin with Politico.com. Did he seem a bit defensive?
He did, actually, today. It was notable, especially because he just had this appearance before the White House Correspondents Association at the big dinner, a lot of Washington pomp and circumstance. But what was interesting in that performance over the weekend was how relaxed he seemed and what a good time he appeared to be having. Very different President Obama. Now, of course, those were very different occasions, but he didn't have that same sense of enjoyment about him today. He kind of looked like a man who would have been much happier if he had been somewhere without the press. And you mentioned the quote about juice. You know, he was asked if he'd lost his juice, and he responded and said, "Golly, I think it's a little, as Mark Twain said, rumors of my demise may be exaggerated at this point." So, you know, it was a good retort, but he was a little bit on the defensive today, partly because he didn't have a big legislative accomplishment to pivot off of. The immigration debate is heating up, and he talked about, you know, if we get that done, it'll be a historic achievement. But that's something that hasn't happened yet. And the things that have happened so far have not gone his way early in his second term. The sequester did come about. He didn't want that to happen. His gun legislation failed in the Senate, and even what they took up was far pared back from what President Obama had wanted them to vote on.
He also said that Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, Republican senator, was wrong when he talked about intelligence failures in Boston and in Benghazi.
He did say that. It was one of several times he took on Congress in this news conference. You heard it in respect to the sequester, in respect to Benghazi. He came out hard swinging against the Republicans in Congress, and that was also a notable moment because he's been working so hard on his outreach lately. You know, we in the media have been writing a fair amount about the dinners he's been having and the sort of Obama charm offensive, as it's been dubbed. That was really not on display at the news conference today.
Although he did say that he thinks there are some Republicans, at least, certainly in the Senate, maybe even in the House, who might effectively, in his opinion, I think, come to reasonable points of view on things.
He did absolutely say that, and you know, if his advisors were here with us on the phone, they would say so. That was absolutely consistent, and those are the Republicans that he's been trying hard to reach out to and to cut a deal. But it's going to be very hard to gather up voices to go against the leadership. That's been a persistent problem, and I think the president alluded to that today.
Rachel Smolkin, Political.com, many thanks. In a moment, the high price of cheap clothing on To the Point.
Check out our new YouTube video channel, The Q. KCRW DJs curate themed video playlists and feature artist clips straight from YouTube. Add some visual to your audio. Explore now at kcrw.com/The Q.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Almost a week after the collapse of a clothing factory in Bangladesh, the search for bodies goes on. Almost 400 are known to have been killed, and horrifying injuries to hundreds more are overwhelming medical resources. Tim Ryan is Asia Regional Program Director for the Solidarity Center. That's run by the AFL-CIO, has an office in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. Tim Ryan was most recently there in February. Tim Ryan, thanks for joining our program today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
This is hardly the only accident that has killed people in the garment industry in Bangladesh. Give us a little bit of history.
Well, going back 10 years, you've had, you know, over 600 people have died in various incidents, fire incidents, building collapses. And so this is sort of an endemic problem to the way the industry is being run there.
And it appears that the goal, not just of the industry, but of the Bangladesh government, is to make sure that the clothes that are manufactured there are the cheapest in Asia.
Absolutely. They are the wage floor in Asia. The minimum wage is $38 a month, which is lower than anywhere else in the region.
Who mainly are the workers in these factories?
Most of the workers are young women. 80 to 85% of the workforce is young women in these factories. Some of whom started work, even though it's illegal, as child laborers as young as 12 or 13.
Tell us a bit about the day-to-day conditions in these factories.
The factories themselves, in Dhaka in particular, in the area surrounding Dhaka, are built, are companies that are inside these buildings that have, like the current disaster, more and more stories built on top of original structures, and that's one of the reasons that led to this collapse. In many of the cases that we've seen, including 41 fire-related incidents since the Tazreen fire last November, you have the repeated picture of all kinds of locked doors, locked fire escapes, inability of people to escape the building if a disaster really does happen, and the working conditions in these factories are, in very many cases, dirty and dangerous.
Locked doors and locked fire escapes?
Absolutely. The situation is people, the managers are concerned, or the companies are concerned about quote-unquote theft. So in these circumstances, you see this repeatedly, where exits are blocked and gates and doors are locked to prevent unauthorized theft or people leaving the building when they shouldn't be.
The owner of this building apparently was told to evacuate it because it was too dangerous before the collapse occurred. He said it was safe, made the workers or allowed the workers to come back in, and of course many were killed. He's now been arrested, and there are demands in the street for him to be prosecuted and even executed. What response has your organization received from government officials and factory owners when you've raised concerns in the past?
Well, one of the things that to keep in mind in terms of trying to improve the conditions in these factories is being able to use a lot of different kinds of tools, okay? Tools like trade pressure, U.S. Trade law pressure, communications with the government and by the U.S. government to the Bangladeshi government to enforce their own laws involving freedom of association. I think it's pretty clear from the stories we hear that a number of these workers saw cracks in the building the day before the collapse occurred, did not want to go back to work, but were coerced by factory managers to get back to work. From our point of view, if those workers were organized and had a collective voice that could stand up to that sort of coercion, this tragedy might not never have happened.
Aren't there 146 unions in Bangladesh?
There is a very, very weak union movement in Bangladesh, but there are opportunities to help workers organize, and that's the primary goal of the Solidarity Center program in Bangladesh.
All right, Tim Ryan, again, Asian Regional Program Director for the Solidarity Center, again, sponsored by the AFL-CIO. Let me go to Avadis Safarian, who's president and CEO of Worldwide Responsible Accredited Production. That's a nonprofit that audits and certifies facilities engaged in lawful and ethical production. Good to have you on our program.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
What about the argument that the Western clothing manufacturers who want to get as cheap a product as they can are in many ways responsible for what we're hearing about what's going on in Bangladesh?
Well, it really is a tragic conversation to be having. This disaster really weighs very heavily on all our hearts, and our thoughts and prayers go to all those impacted. Arguments like that are naturally going to come up in light of events like this. And the reality is that today's highly competitive market is always going to have price pressures be part of the conversation. You're not going to be in business if you don't have competitively sourced products that you can then make available to your customers. What does not follow from that, however, is that these products necessarily have to come from factories that are operated under unsafe and unhealthy conditions. You can certainly have competitive sourced goods available in factories that obey the regulations and laws and maintain internationally accepted working conditions for their workers. And Bangladesh has many such examples of factories where products are made that are competitively priced but are made under conditions that are humane, ethical, meeting international standards. And that's the kind of factories that we want to promote, and that's the kind of work that RAP does in Bangladesh to ensure those conditions and certify and verify them on the ground.
Did RAP, your organization, inspect the factory that collapsed?
No, none of the factories in the collapse building were currently RAP certified. We had in the past been to one of those factories, and in fact, our follow-up audits at that facility about 13 months ago had indicated significant problems in there, and we try to work with the factory to improve, as we try and do with all the factories, because we're trying to encourage a positive approach to help them get where they need to. But they did not engage with us as we wished them. We would have wanted them to, and that factory certification lapsed, and it was not renewed.
So that
other factories in the building were up-certified.
Yeah, one building had several factories, different factories in it, and I gather that's sometimes common. Why is it that some factories agree to talk with you and allow you to inspect and perhaps make changes at your recommendation, and others don't?
That is actually a very good question. I think it comes down to a sense of enlightenment, I suppose, is a good way of putting it, on the part of the folks who run these factories, and understanding that it is going to be in their interest as businesses, not just from a morals case, which is obviously not debatable, but from a business perspective, it is important for them to be able to showcase their factories as being responsible sourcing partners, and therefore enabling them to get better relationships with their buyers, and more importantly, better and more productive and efficient workforces by ensuring good conditions for their workers to operate in, and increase their morale, their productivity, their longevity, and all in all, just be better for business.
Avadis Severian, again, with Worldwide Responsible Accredited Production, that's WRAP, a nonprofit auditing and certifying facilities, is engaged in lawful and ethical production. Richard Locke, professor at MIT Sloan School of Management, author of The Promise and Limits of Private Power, Promoting Labor Standards in a Global Economy. That's just out this month. Richard Locke, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you.
You spent a long time looking at the global supply chain. What emphasis should there be, do you think, on the brand name people who, in fact, buy their clothing from factories such as the ones that were subject to the collapse?
Well, I think that what we have to pay attention to is what role do these global brands, but also large retailers, play in these tragedies. And I think it's more than just placing orders in factories that will give them, you know, sort of cheap prices. And the way they get these cheap prices is by, you know, not respecting laws, work hours, and in this most recent case, building codes.
Human rights, it would seem to me.
Basic human rights in many ways. But it seems that another thing that we have to pay attention to is what are the kinds of upstream business practices that these brands have, which is to reduce lead times, to introduce multiple products at the same time, to try to offer cheaper prices from one year to the other. What kinds of pressures do these kinds of practices, which they control — it's not something that goes on in these third world countries, but these practices that they control — how does that actually create the kinds of conditions that unfortunately lead to the kinds of tragedies we just witnessed last week?
So elaborate a bit on that. What sorts of upstream practices, in addition to lead times and multiple product introductions, can you point to, and how would those things work to the advantage of the workers in the factories?
So I think what we've seen in the last, let's say, decade or so is that a lot of brands and large retailers, for their own reasons, don't want to hold on to inventory. For example, in consumer electronics, I think the average life cycle of a consumer electronics product is 9 months. So these large stores, which control something like 75% of the electronics market, don't want to hold inventory. So therefore, they don't buy it from the brands. The brands themselves don't want to hold this inventory because they're afraid that it won't sell. And so what they've done is they've changed their whole production system and supply chain management system so that they're ordering things at the very last moment based on sort of pull-based system or point-of-sale data. They are trying to use modular production mechanisms, so that you can use the same kinds of components, whether it's in your iPad or AirBook or something like that. And so they wait for the very last moment to place the order. And what you'll see is, by pushing things as far as they can so that they don't hold the risk, what they're essentially doing is pushing that risk onto the factory floors. And you start seeing wild variations in production orders, hence work hours, and hence the hiring and firing of temporary migrant workers. So that's one thing that they do. Also, another thing that they do is, because they've seemed to be having trouble with their own market forecasting, they keep on introducing more and more products, and they introduce them at the same time. And every time you introduce a new product, whether it's a garment or an electronics, the factory workers who have to make it, it takes them a while to sort of get the hang of it. And so their productivity goes down not only with every new product introduction, but if you're introducing lots of them at the same time, the productivity goes down. The only way to make up for that is to ask workers to work longer hours, don't take breaks, don't take days off, et cetera. And eventually that leads to all sorts of public health or accident rates. What I thought was so interesting about the quotes coming out of Bangladesh last week was the factory manager saying, we had to do it because we had pressure to get the orders out. Those pressures are pressures that we as consumers have generated on the retailers, and the retailers in turn have generated to their brands and their suppliers.
Okay, we'll talk a bit later more about the retailers. The consumers. I first want to go back to Tim Ryan with the Solidarity Center. What do you say to what we're happening from hearing from Richard Locke at MIT? Does that sound right to you, that these are the kinds of pressures that cause the factory floor situation to be as deplorable as it is?
I think that's absolutely right. I think Mr. Locke's analysis of all of this has been very, very detailed and very, very good on all of the technical details and the way this works down the supply chain. There are other aspects of this which I think are important in terms of self-regulation or self-policing, which is one of the things that we feel, because of the supply chain structure and because of the various pressures and the economic necessities that Mr. Locke is describing, makes it really difficult for the industry to really police itself.
Mm-hmm. Richard Locke, what about policing by the brand name companies, for example, which can take a lot of heat, as many of them have, when disasters like this occur, and the sort of voluntary inspections that we heard talked about before, do those work?
Yeah, I agree with the point that was just raised, that we know from years and years of research now that simply doing voluntary self-regulation, policing, auditing, monitoring systems, that's better than nothing, but it doesn't lead to significant and sustained improvements. This book that I just did basically looks at 10 years of data of the large brands, Nike, Hewlett-Packard, and others, and evaluating their private monitoring, auditing programs. And they don't really work. And they don't work because it's not merely a story of policing. You know, policing really is, you know, you have to be there often enough, and you have to have credible penalties and stuff like that. What we want to do is not get into that kind of cat and mouse game, but rather what we have to do is face a couple facts. And one of the facts is that the managers of a lot of these factories simply don't have the capabilities that they need to run efficient, let alone ethical operations. But if you train them to engage in better purchasing practices or human resource management practices or operations of their factory floor, not only will their profits go up, but hopefully some of those profits will be distributed to better wages and better working conditions.
Okay. Hold that thought for a moment, if you will, because I want to get a response from Mr. Safarian of the Worldwide Responsible Accredited Production Organization. In the meantime, we need to take a brief break. We'll come back and continue this conversation. On Reporter's Notebook later, we'll talk with Jim Wallace of Sojourners, and he will reflect on the common good, the subject of his latest book. He'll be with us here in the studio. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Norman Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the collapse of the factory, or the factories, all in one building in Bangladesh last week. 400 people dead. Many more may also have suffered death. They are still searching for bodies. Some of the injuries include crushed rib cages and amputations, most of the workers being younger women who are making in Bangladesh $38 a month. It is reputed that Bangladesh has the lowest floor in the garment industry in Asia and wants to stay that way. We're talking about how things might be made better. We just heard from Richard Locke at MIT, who's written The Promise and Limits of Private Power, Promoting Labor Standards in a Global Economy. I want to go back now to Abadis Safarian at Worldwide Responsible Accredited Production, which certifies and audits facilities. What do you say to the argument that self-policing simply doesn't work?
Well, I think Richard Locke's point is certainly well taken. We all recognize the limitations on a pure audit model, and I think while all of us understand the importance of audits and the service they provide in terms of information gathering mechanisms, the fact remains that you're never going to audit a factory into compliance just by doing more and more monitoring. And further, the point he was making is where the weak link is in the capacity at the management level of knowing how to do the various things that they need to do in order to get the facility to the standards they need to be, which is why at RAP, what we've been doing over the last several years is concentrating a lot on providing precisely those tools to build capacity in the form of various training courses and our approach generally being to try and foster a climate where a systemic approach to compliance is taught to these factories. It's not something that comes naturally. It isn't something that is inherent in the way businesses are run, factories are run in Bangladesh right now. A very good example is a very effective fire safety training program that we've had in place in Bangladesh now for a year and a half. We've had an office in Bangladesh, in Dhaka, since February of 2011, and in September of 2011, we put out this one-day fire safety training course that's focused on workers and managers, without ignoring the fact that, you know, a lot of these fire training courses are focused on evacuation, on getting workers out safely. That's all well and good. You want to make sure people get out safely in the event of a fire. But the more important thing is to train them on understanding how to go about preventing fires from happening in the first place. And that's what this course focuses on hazard analysis, on risk assessment, on the kind of management system tools that they need to understand and implement in their factories so that they can actually prevent these things from happening rather than having to deal with the horrific consequences after the fact.
Okay, pretty hard to evacuate, too, if the doors and the fire escapes are locked, as we heard about earlier in our program. Tim Ryan, back to you with the Solidarity Center, with an office in Dhaka, Bangladesh, recently there in February. How difficult is it to penetrate into the factories themselves when it appears that the government of Bangladesh simply isn't interested in enforcing its own laws?
Well, you know, this is the other, I think, really key weak link in the system, in the situation. Because, you know, if the Bangladesh government would enforce its own law and companies would also recognize and comply with the law, you would have the opportunity for workers to have real freedom of association and really actually form their own organizations. And frankly speaking, there's nobody better to understand what's going on in a factory on a day-to-day basis than the workers themselves. If you can foster that relationship where workers can talk to management and interact with them, there can be a way for them to help solve these problems together. And so creating that space so that workers have the opportunity to form their own organizations is absolutely critical.
Richard Locke, back to you at MIT. What's happened in other Asian countries which also manufacture clothing? You indicated earlier that if people adopt the appropriate practices, they can actually not only have safer working conditions, but cheap clothes and make money at the same time.
Yeah, I think what we've seen through pretty extensive research is that when you complement traditional factory compliance programs with the kind of capability building initiatives that were described earlier, where you can actually teach these managers how to run efficient and also more ethical operations, when you do those things, what you end up doing is increasing margins, reducing unit costs, and improving labor standards. However, it's not merely just sort of a technical solution, right? So you can't just sort of do the training and hope that it all works out. That's where, as the Solidarity Center speaker made a very important point, which is that it also involves distributional issues, which are fundamentally political. And so where workers have the rights to associate freely, where they can bargain, where their rights are being protected, and those can only be protected by the state. They can't be protected one factory at a time. Where you have those, then it's in fact empirically been shown that these private initiatives are much more effective than when they operate in countries that don't have strong institutions, strong rule of law.
And which countries can you say have those things, and should we look on the labels?
Yeah, so I would say that we've seen some incredibly interesting experiences recently, for example, in Brazil, where the Brazilian Ministry of Labor and the public prosecutors have been working with firms and NGOs to improve both competitiveness and labor standards. There's been a terrific, now decade-long experience in Cambodia with the Better Factory Cambodia program, which brought together the ILO, at one point the U.S. government, other NGOs, brands, and the local Cambodian government to improve standards as well as efficiency and quality in the factories. We've seen other work, very good work, in the Dominican Republic and even in some cases in China. So we're beginning to see experiences that show that one can, even in a world of global supply chains, have competitive prices, but not at the expense of the rights of the workers.
Richard Locke, again, a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, author of The Promise and Limits of Private Power, Promoting Labor Standards in a Global Economy. Thanks so much for being on our program today.
Thank you for having me. It's great. Take care.
Okay. Tim Ryan, back to you. Should consumers then be thinking about what it says on the label and buy clothes that come out of where the kinds of practices just enumerated by Richard Locke are in effect?
I think that's one approach. I think the other approach, and I think this is a very important point to make, that neither the Solidarity Center nor the AFL-CIO is in favor of something like a boycott of, you know, garments from Bangladesh. The point here is to try to work on all of the different players, whether it's the brands, the Bangladeshi government, and the company, to improve the conditions, because workers need to work. Workers need jobs. But you also have to have a sustainable economic development model, which Bangladesh, essentially, by relying on this low-wage, low-standard approach to the garment industry over the last 30 years, has, in a sense, been left behind when you look around at some of its neighbors in the region. So the idea is you can look at the label and you can, consumers can vote with their dollars, but they should also vote with their voices. And the way that, for instance, social media works now, there's an opportunity to get messages to the brands to pay just a little bit more per unit cost, which can actually help increase wages for workers at the lowest level. The other piece of this is when you look at talking to the brands about conditions, the brands can also be helpful when it comes to communicating with their contractors, with their companies, and saying, look, under the law, freedom of association is the law of the land. Many of these brands have codes of conduct, which, again, are often just sort of, you know, words on a page, but often they say implementation of all existing labor laws and freedom of association. This is where the brands can put their money where their mouth is, so to speak.
Okay. Let me introduce Chris Moran. He's just joined us. He's senior editor of Consumerist.com. That's an online consumer blog owned by the publisher of Consumer Reports. Good to have you on our program.
Good afternoon, Warren. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you, and we appreciate your coming on aboard. What about the responsibility of consumers? We all want cheap clothes, cheaper and cheaper, it seems to be better and better, and yet if people are dying as a result, do we have some responsibility to be careful, and how can we best exercise that responsibility?
I personally think, yes, we do have some responsibility. I think I do also think it's getting harder and harder to sort out these things. Take Foxconn, for instance. Until a few years ago, your average consumer hadn't heard of it. And honestly, your average consumer probably still hasn't heard of Foxconn. But your average news reader knows about it, specifically because of, you know, there was the Apple scandal in the last year or so. Because Apple has this reputation of being very employee-friendly and being very human rights forward. but people were learning about human rights violations, alleged rights violations at Foxconn. But what people
that's a manufacturer in Asia.
It's the world's largest manufacturer, not just in Asia. They're in South America. They have, I think, more than a dozen plants. They're actually talking about opening a couple in the U.S. And they make things for everybody. They make it's not just a you can't determine based on price anymore. You can't say, oh well, Apple must be good because it's a $2,000 laptop, so therefore I'm paying a higher price and they're paying their employees more. It's the same company that actually assembles it that makes the $600 Acer laptop that you buy. Yeah, so the price tag isn't an indicator of how the employees who make the goods are being treated.
So how do you find out then? How do you send a message to the brand, as Tim Ryan suggests we all ought to do?
In addition to just sending a message to the brand, and you can go to Apple, you can go to the clothing manufacturers, but the big thing is to go to the large retailers. Go to the Macy's, go to the Walmarts, the Best Buys, and let them know your feelings about these companies, about how these employees are being treated, because they have much more leverage than you do. Walmart is the world's largest retailer. They buy an inordinate number of electronics and apparel. And if they were to say to a manufacturer, look, you need to improve your supply chain, not just the efficiency of it, but the ethics of the way the employees are being treated, then that will have to happen. Apple can't say no to that. An apparel company can't say no to Walmart. They literally just have that much leverage.
Chris Moran again with Consumerist.com. Abadis Safarian, back to you with the Worldwide Responsible Accreditation or Accredited Program, RAP, the nonprofit that audits these facilities. How do you find out if a retailer says, oh, we only get our material from certified factories where they treat their workers humanely? How do we know that's true? In some cases, it's turned out not to be.
Indeed, the global supply chain really is a very complex and becoming more so. That's why when we do our work, we focus ultimately on the production site. When you're asking a retailer, where do you get your product from? Some of these retailers go through agents, go through subcontractors. How transparent the supply chain is, even to the retailer, may not necessarily be clear. I think the solution, therefore, is to say, regardless of however many layers you're going through, as the purchasing decision devolves further and further down, the directive has to be wherever it is you source from, you have to make sure that it is a socially responsible manufacturing partner. And you could say, RAP certification might be one thing that you would look for this, because our work focuses on that production point. We only certify production facilities, not supply chains or buying houses. It's the factory itself that ultimately is the site where, if there are going to be any worker rights issues, that's where they will take place. So our work is focused on the production unit. We certify the factories. And the way for a retailer, for a brand, for a buyer to ensure that they have an ethical supply chain is that whichever point that the purchasing decision is being made, it is being made with the directive that the purchasing be from a RAP-certified factory.
So, Chris Moran, back to you with Consumerist.com. How does a consumer find out where the best practices are, in fact, in effect? And do you, for example, do any kind of accreditation, or do you refer to others that do, so that people don't have to do too much work before they buy a shirt?
We personally don't, just because we don't have the ability to, but no, it is something that more and more people are reporting on. And for instance, recently, it was in the last year, there was an Amazon warehouse in Pennsylvania where the workers were talking about the conditions there. There were no exhaust fans. The doors were being shut. They were working long hours in incredible heat. And they went to the local media. And because they went to the local media, it's now become there's a large number of people out there who are putting pressure on Amazon to treat their employees not just at that warehouse better, but at all their warehouses better, and they're building more warehouses, so it's becoming a bigger topic. So it is, you have to do research. There is no single source that I know of that covers domestic and foreign warehousing and manufacturing. So that is the difficulty. And like I said, the consolidation of manufacturing makes it very difficult too, because you have one company working that manufactures for 60 different brands. So it is hard to know these behind the scenes players. They're not companies that your average person on the street would know.
In Pennsylvania, though, unlike Bangladesh, apparently, and some other countries as well, people do have the right to speak up. So if you listen to the workers, you're suggesting that's one way of finding out what's really going on.
Exactly. And, you know, even though you know, some of these countries and some of these municipalities where the overseas where people work, they're under pretty strict rules to not speak publicly about the companies. Some of them are. Again, going back to Foxconn, most of what we know about Foxconn came because of, sadly, worker suicides and worker protests. Because of those, then it became a public topic. And the local media wasn't writing about it. Certainly the international media wasn't writing about these conditions until these terribly unfortunate deaths made it very public. And now it's become it's become a growing topic, and there's more and more focus on electronics manufacturing because of that.
Tim Ryan, back to you. Do you think that there's going to be a reform in Bangladesh as a result of this incident, which has certainly caused worldwide concern, and many programs such as the one we're all engaged in here are being conducted, I suspect. Certainly there's been a lot of reporting about it, and it's been very embarrassing to lots of different companies, and I would think to the nation of Bangladesh. They might be worried that companies will pull out.
This is a really good question, and it's difficult to answer in the sense that I've been working on and off in Bangladesh for the last 15 years, and I feel like I've seen moments like this before. For instance, there was a huge fire in 2000 in Dhaka. As a result, actually, the Solidarity Center put on first fire safety training program in 2001-2002, which was the first time that the unions and the workers could really begin to engage with management, because they really saw it, obviously, at that point, was in their interest to deal with this. Yet here we're having this conversation, 12, 13 years later. My feeling is that I mentioned earlier that people try to use all the tools in the toolbox, and in the context of really trying to effect change on labor standards and issues like freedom of association and collective bargaining, at least in countries in Asia, what we've seen is you got to have all the tools working together at the same time. The unfortunate thing here is that there was a horrible, horrible tragedy. If this tragedy can be the linchpin that sort of is the tipping point where, okay, now we're really going to have to start getting serious about fire safety. If the governments and the companies say, we're really going to have to do this, we're really going to have to fill the factory inspector's positions. Right now, half of the factory inspector positions in the Bangladesh government are empty. And if they're empowered on some level to actually do their job, because it's a very, very corrupt sort of situation, there may be an opportunity to do this, but you need all the different pieces working at once. One of the pressures...
I'm sorry, we're simply out of time. Let us hope that this is, in fact, a tipping point. In the meantime, we'll try to come back and revisit the issue on future programs. Tim Ryan, again, with the Solidarity Center, the AFL-CIO, recently has been in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Our earlier guest, Richard Locke of MIT, Avadis Safarian with Worldwide Responsible Accreditation Program, or RAP, and Chris Moran, senior editor of Consumerist.com, owned by the publishers of Consumer Reports. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Jim Wallace is an evangelical Christian preacher. He's a public intellectual. He's the editor of Sojourners magazine, which he founded. He says his latest book is designed to promote what he calls an ancient but timely idea and practice, the common good. We'll hear what he means by that in a moment on To the Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Abraham Lincoln famously said, "My concern is not whether God is on our side. My greatest concern is to be on God's side." On God's Side is the title of Jim Wallace's latest book, the subtitle, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. Jim Wallace is with us in the studio now. And Jim Wallace, it's great to see you.
Great to be in your home base here.
You wrote this on a sabbatical during which you spent a lot of time looking at the public discourse such as it is and found it very embarrassing in this country. That's what led you to write to The Common Good?
I took a three-month discipline during the election year last year not to speak or write or be interviewed about politics, but every morning to get up and have some quiet and exercise and read and write about the common good. But I watch it at night, you know. And the more I watched it, the more depressing it all became, the vitriol, the combat, the fear, the polarization, the paralyzation. And I realize how much we've lost this ancient idea, goes back centuries, called the common good. It's in all of our faith traditions, but also in our secular democratic ones. So I'm 18 cities trying to figure out how to help spark a national conversation about the common good.
So this would involve then people obviously on different sides of different issues. Does it mean reconciliation of arguments about the economy or politics?
Well, it means trying to find – in Washington, D.C., both sides take a problem and they want to make us afraid of it and blame the other side. They really are not looking at how to solve our problems. Now, I talk about the one thing they may do. I think they will by the August recess, is immigration reform. But that's been pressure from the outside to get them to do the right thing. And they actually kind of like the idea they might do the right thing in a bipartisan positive way. But they'll tell you it's been the faith community and business and law enforcement that's helped them to do this from the outside. The common good comes last to Washington, where the checks have replaced all the balances in our public life.
Tell us what you mean by the common good and why do you get to define it?
Well, you know, Lincoln didn't always know what it meant to be on God's side, but he said that's the right question. Don't bring God onto our side. Religion makes that mistake and politics does. But he says ask the question, what does it mean to be on God's side? Same with the common good. I can't sit here and say these are the 10 things for the common good, but that's the right question. So conservatives who've read the book say, I may not always agree with your policy statements, but this dialogue about the common good is what we most need. On your last topic, which I was listening to, I've got a chapter called The Good Samaritan Goes Global. It was a lawyer that asked Jesus the question, who is my neighbor? And I think it was a Washington lawyer who asked him that question. It wasn't with a tone of voice, who is my neighbor? I want to help. It was, who is my neighbor? And so I was talking to a group of CEOs and NGOs about the Congo and the minerals that make our cell phones. And how those the money from it's going to warlords who are buying weapons to pillage so many people. And I said, pull your cell phones out. It was over lunch, and they all did. I said, this is your significant other, okay? Whoever helps make this cell phone is your neighbor. Let's talk about turning supply chains into value chains. So I've got a whole chapter on this, how businesses, just as you were saying, are being challenged now. And the question spiritually is, who is my neighbor? And the foundation for the common good is the second commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself. What does that mean? Our neighbor is not just our group and our team and our tribe and our party. And so this book says, how can we extend the definition of the neighbor, and then apply that to the economy, role of government, democracy, and even our households?
But it seems to me one of the things I came away with after the discussion we just had was that it's very difficult to find out who are the good actors and who are the bad actors. How do you do that? And if you want to pursue the common good in the way that you're suggesting, starting out perhaps with human rights, perhaps we can all agree that that's mm-hmm. part of the common good. Isn't there a challenge that a lot of people simply don't have the time for?
Well, you know, on immigration, I'm very hopeful. I'm seeing Republicans and Democrats, Senate, look me in the eye.
How many people are listening to our program?
Well, I think the people who are listening are the ones making a difference on immigration. I mean, we're changing public opinion. 11 million undocumented people got stuck between two signs. It says one said no trespass, the other one said help wanted, you know. And that system is broken. And Washington was not going to change it. So the book talks about how social movements are what change things. On this issue of business and protecting human rights, there is a growing movement among young people. The book's written to the largest growing affiliation for religion is called the Nuns, none of the aboves. You know? And I've written the book to them. They want to make a difference my Georgetown students. They don't want to wear T-shirts made by kids who are being exploited. So this commitment to the common good, I think, can change politics, but only if we make different decisions. And the book talks about what those decisions are.
What about people of different faiths who disagree and who say that to compromise with the other guy's faith is, in fact, sacrilegious and they can't do it?
Well, you know, to love your neighbor as yourself is really in Judaism, Islam, in Christianity, it's in our secular traditions as well. So I'm meeting all over the country with young leaders from many faith traditions, and they're saying, you be the best Muslim you can be, best Christian you can be, and we'll find where we have common ground. I think Washington is in terrible trouble, and unless we build movements from the outside, you almost have to hold their hands to get them to do immigration reform. But the White House would tell you, the Republicans, Democrats, that they wouldn't be doing this if the pressure wasn't coming from outside. Guns. We just had 90% of the American people wanting common sense changes. And Washington said no because they're controlled by gun manufacturers who supply gun lobbies. I'm calling them gun runners who are thwarting democracy in Washington. So the book is about how we can make decisions in our lives, congregations, communities, families, and workplaces and schools that really can build social movements to change even Washington over time.
So we have very little time left, but you start with the personal.
Yeah, you know, I'm a Little League baseball coach and a dad, and I think hope is what people are really hungry for. Skepticism is good, asking hard questions. Cynicism is dangerous because it's a buffer against commitment. And what changes things is having a vision of change and then betting your life on it. And anybody can do that. The civil rights movement happened because millions of people made decisions in their own lives. And that's what finally changed the culture. In Washington, D.C., the politicians have suits and ties and run around with their fingers in the air to see which way the wind is blowing. I'm saying we have to be wind changers. That's what this book is all about.
Jim Wallace, the book is On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. Good luck with the book, and I hope your Little League team wins. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Kerry Cavanaugh, Evan George, and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.